It's Joe Pardavilla, and you're listening to the Forbes Books Podcast. And recently, I came to find a term that I never heard before: luxury American whiskey. And when I say luxury, I mean luxury. Julie Macklow, the founder of the Macklow American Single Malt Whiskey, describes her whiskey as the Ferrari of single malts. Suggested retail price, $1,500. And there are fewer than 250 bottles available. So what's it all about? Joining me today on the podcast is the aforementioned Julie Macklow. Julie has quite a story. She is an investor, former hedge fund manager, philanthropist, socialite. She founded her own skincare company. But now she's introducing us all to an entirely new category for luxury American single malts within the wine and spirits industry. Julie, welcome to the podcast.
Nice to be here. I'm super excited.
And Julie, I'm super excited to talk to you because you are sort of like a modern literary character. You're like a Bret Easton Ellis novel where you have this like amazing life where you've been all over the world and doing things. Has this always been in your nature where you're always doing something? Because I feel like there's never a dull moment in Julie Macklow's life.
That is for sure. We use the term modern Renaissance Day woman.
I like that.
I never get bored. I don't like to get bored, so I keep myself fairly occupied. I feel like probably since I was out of the womb.
That's awesome. And so I know you kind of built your career in the financial industry, and now you're an entrepreneur, but let's go back. And so those early days of working in finance, being incredibly successful, how did that prepare you for entrepreneurship? Because people don't usually do the track that you took. Like, they'll usually, start up, maybe work in the corporate field for a couple of years and then go entrepreneurship. But you were working corporate jobs for many, many years before you decided to found a skincare company and a whiskey company.
So I had an unusual, I'd say, upbringing and definitely an interesting career path. I was born in Aspen, Colorado. I was there basically till I was about 12, and then a couple of years in New York City, and I went to a large public high school in Phoenix, Arizona. And then I went to University of Virginia, where I was recruited out of University of Virginia to work at Chase Capital Partners. And the option at the time was go into fashion, which I really loved, or go work in finance, which paid you a lot of money. So since I graduated in 3 years with three degrees, because basically I couldn't afford the fourth year, I decided, hey, it sounds like a better idea to get paid a lot of money and go into finance. So that was definitely the career path I chose. I was lucky enough that after doing a summer internship for Goldman Sachs and mergers and acquisitions, I was recruited into private equity right out of college for a firm that was then called Chase Capital Partners, which became JP Morgan Partners. And they every couple of years would recruit someone straight out of college. Myself, I got very lucky. And it was a wonderful start in private equity, which very few people get to do right out of school. After doing that for about 4 years, in that process, they actually needed somebody to go to Israel. So I raised my hand and went to Israel. Then they needed an analyst in Asia. So I moved myself to Hong Kong. I primarily worked actually in Korea. After living in Asia for about 2 years, I moved back. Again, I sort of toyed with this idea of going into fashion because I always loved fashion. But sure enough, I was offered a hedge fund job, which paid much better. So I moved back to New York City and worked for two hedge funds who actually shared office, but the primary one was Metropolitan Capital. And it was a value-based hedge fund where I was there for about 4 years. And then I decided to go swim with the sharks. And there was this guy who I think we've all heard of, Steve Cohen.
Yes.
Who ran at the time SAC and Sigma. And so I took a job running his consumer retail portfolio. I'm pretty sure I was his only female portfolio manager. And I was with Steve about 4 years. And then I had the fortunate position to go work for another very well-known guy, Israel Englander at Millennium, under my own name, Macklow Capital. And I was there about 2 years when I started investing in some little startups. One was called Bauble Bar that I became part of the advisory board. And I was like, this is really cool working with these entrepreneurs. They have so much great energy. After doing, a decade and a half in finance, I was getting a little bit bored running money and just seeing sort of making decisions about companies versus really understanding what is inventory, what is working capital, how do things actually work on a balance sheet. I thought to myself, it'd be really cool to actually work in a company and have a company. So I started sort of brainstorming what that company might be. At first I was thinking, oh, I'm going to do a surf makeup company. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I don't really surf. And then everyone always said to me, oh, you have great skin. What skincare do you use? So probably not the most logical decision, but I decided to start a skincare company called V-Beauté. And I'll never forget, I had this travel kit, and the inspiration was actually my husband and I had been at a girlfriend of mine's wedding in Deauville and in Versailles. And I, back then, was much more responsible in my packing, and I could pack for a 5-day black tie event, no problem, in a suitcase. Wow. That was travel on. But the TSA guys actually took my toiletries, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is terrible. So I created this thing called the It Kit, which was your 5 daily essential things that you would need, a cleanser, exfoliator, eye cream, face serum, face cream, that fit in this tidy little kit. And I remember I took it to Bergdorf Goodman's, met with Linda Fargo, and she's like, I love the concept, but where's the full size? I was like, oh, yes, that'll be coming right up. So then we worked on the full size, launched V-Beauté. We started with Bergdorf, Neiman's, Nordstrom's. We got in about 200 boutiques, including Fred Siegel's. I really had no idea what I was doing at all, to be quite honest. After doing that for about 2.5 years, everyone's like, you should be on Home Shopping Network. You've got a great story, because our signature ingredient was the Swiss Alpine Rose, which would last for 100 years, die, rejuvenate itself, and magically that plant would bring the same power into your skin. And basically, we went to Home Shopping Network, pitched the idea, and I spent the next 7 years or so on Home Shopping Network, day and night, 24/7. People don't understand Home Shopping Network is a very glamorous channel to look at, but when you're there, you're basically working 36 wow. hours straight without sleeping. So after doing that for about 7 years, I actually was going to launch an organic skincare. I got pregnant at the time with my later in life child. I have one who's about 15 and the other one just turned 4. And I had this moment of pause. And I'd always been thinking, you know, skincare is great, but I always struggled with why did I have authority? I'm not a dermatologist. I don't know why I started a skincare company. Yes, I have great skin, but it wasn't something that was authentic to my personality. So during this, you know, lull, I was like, you know, what I really like is whiskey and golf. What I know how to do is packaging in bottles and put things in bottles because of the skincare business. And I was staring at my whiskey collection that I was organizing in a new bar we had built in my apartment. And I realized I have over 2,000 bottles of single malt scotch. And wow. Back to Korea, I started collecting all of these bottles when I was holed up working in finance in Korea. I would basically fly each week from Hong Kong to Korea, and I'd spend all my dinner allowance on wine, champagne, or scotch. Scotch lasted the longest. I got drunk quickest on it. So I really gravitated towards that, more bang for the buck, and, you know, I was young. So
that's amazing.
One bottle at a time, I amassed this massive collection of whiskeys, much to my husband's chagrin, and I was staring at it. I'm like, wait, I have amazing scotches, 1936 to present day. I have Japanese, Taiwanese, Irish, Canadian, all of these different regions. But I realized there was nothing that was luxury, American, and single malt, which is 100% malted barley, water, and yeast. Yes, there's bourbons, but there had never been a luxury American single malt. Wow. So I thought to myself, why not go create it? Obviously, I'd lost my mind.
Well, it's funny. You lost your mind for many different levels, but I was curious because I want to step back a little bit. Because in those years of finance, in a way, you almost saw how the sausage was made with all these companies you were investing in. So you sort of like had the back end stuff ready when you became an entrepreneur. The other stuff, I guess, came naturally, where it was the packaging, the marketing. But all of the stuff that you were good at is the stuff that most entrepreneurs are not. Like, they're really good at vision and packaging things and selling things to people, but they're not really good at the bottom line and working behind the scenes.
And it's funny you said that, because I had the advantage that I knew how to raise capital. I knew how to run a cap table. I knew, and I still build out my own business models to the point of crazy amounts of detail, starting with the cost of goods and the sales drivers and the balance sheet. And I can tie cash flow statement together. And I think that has given me an advantage to understand things like cash flow that a lot of people don't understand when they start companies. The harder part for me was that I did not have a marketing background. Mm-hmm. I had no idea what I was doing, especially when I did V-Beauté. I didn't know about sales or training or education or distribution. And those were really interesting lessons that frankly became the core unit when I launched my whiskey business that Ari, I viewed it as almost the internship I had and needed to make the whiskey business successful. But at the time, I didn't realize that's what was really happening.
Interesting. So in a way, you had the financial background. V-Beauté was sort of like your MBA. And then you were ready to launch Macklow Whiskey because of all this prior experience.
It's scary similar, and I'm still shocked by how similar. People are like, how did you break through the alcohol business? We're in 120 of the Michelin 1-2-3 star best venues in New York City. I'd say we are the only luxury American single malt. We are the best positioning in all of these restaurants. And I have people all the time come to me and say, how did you become the hottest launch of the biggest whiskey brand that we've seen? But the reality is it's so similar to skincare. It's about education, staffing, training, distribution. And these were all lessons that I really screwed up in V-Beauté. And it took a lot longer for me to figure out that path. So when I decided to start American Single Malt, the first thing I did before I even had a packaging concept, when I just had my positioning framework, I went to Magliocco's, who run Empire Distribution. I sat with John Sr. and Joey, who runs Michter's. I told them about my concept. And I asked them if it was the white space that I thought it was. And this is almost 4 years prior to launch. And luckily, they really loved the idea. They said it was white space. No one was even thinking about American single malt. It's just about to get approved tomorrow as a category, actually, and then formally approved, hopefully, by the spring. But the comment period ends for TTB. So it's very timely. But this was 4 years ago. And it wasn't on anyone's radar. So I think what I did differently is we really found white space. It's authentic to me. Like when I used to go to benefits, a girlfriend of mine the other day, we were having lunch at Casa Lever, and she's like, you know, I remember you 20 years ago at New Yorkers for Children in a big, great blue ball gown, sitting at the bar, ordering a whiskey neat. And I'm like, who is this woman? Mm-hmm. The reality is drinking single malt has always been a very authentic thing to me personally. And my exploration of that category has always been one of great interest. So unlike a skincare company where I really wasn't sure why I was doing it, I really enjoyed doing it, but couldn't tell you why I made skincare, I really have a passion for the whiskey business.
That's awesome. And I want to ask you about whiskey because full disclosure here, Julie, I'm not a dark spirits drinker because I feel like dark spirits intimidate me. I'm not familiar with
It does. So it's funny you say that. One of the things, I assume you've seen our bottle.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, and if you haven't, it's at themacklow.com, of course. One of the challenges I wanted to address in the whiskey business that all the packaging I felt was super male-focused. Mm-hmm. It was not a conversation that was inclusive of women. And yet there's so many people like yourself, like myself, many women, people who haven't drank a dark spirit, who get ultra intimidated by brown spirits because they're so nerdy and geeky. And we wanted to create this idea of a lifestyle that was iconic, inviting, inclusive of all gender, all people, and that really welcomed people to have the conversation. That you drink what you like, not what you're told to like, that everyone can be part of the conversation with whiskey. And the amount of friends, and especially girlfriends I've converted who have considered themselves tequila drinkers, who then try a sip of the Macklow whiskey and they're just blown away how much they like it. And they're now being part of that conversation as well. And I think that's really where we've been able to change the conversation.
Interesting. Yeah, because when it comes to like your typical beer drinker or vodka drinker or something like that, even wine drinker, where it's like you could just keep drinking it, but whiskey, it's a more of a, it's a different mindset when it comes to drinking that beverage, right?
Well, I mean, yes. So look, at the super high end, our shots are selling for $200 to $400 on premise for a glass of whiskey. So yes, we recommend that. This is our private collection. We recommend it neat with some water side of ice. Our Kentucky four-year release, which will come out this time next year, will be more of your $40 glass mixed cocktail. I see a Macklow Manhattan in your future with that, a whiskey sour. There's many ways to drink that.
Okay.
But I think when something's super high-end and super luxury, we really do recommend enjoying it like you would with a cordial or a cognac or any after-dinner drink, and just maybe a cube or two, just because that is what it is about, the luxury experience of smelling it, tasting the aromas, having it on your palate, and the exploration. I think our customers really love that part of it. That being said, you should drink it how you like it. You want to go have a $200 Macklow Manhattan, by all means, go for it. I've seen it on a couple bar menus, in fact.
That's awesome. And, all right, so for me, you know, imagine I'm one of your girlfriends, you're hanging out, and you're telling me about the Macklow. Should I work my way up to the Macklow? I probably shouldn't just order a whiskey. Whiskey.
Well, if you're
Macklow,
my friend, you better order it first.
Okay. Okay.
But, I mean, we do recommend it as obviously a drink when you sit down, when your palate's fresh, or something to enjoy with your dessert paired with a great chocolate, a sticky toffee pudding. A lot of our MSRP on the bottle is $1,500. I know most of my friends would save it for a special celebration, yeah, an occasion, much like champagne. And one of my favorite heroines would be Madame Clicquot. So I've actually had the luxury of staying at her home in Reims, which is amazing. So when I think of our drink, it is a celebration drink. It is a special occasion drink. Our signature release that'll come in, amazing different bottle next year this time, will be more the everyday Macklow,
nice,
but still at an MSRP at $350. It's not a mass drink, right? It's not your, you know, gin and tonic that you're having.
Got it. Yeah, all right. So I'll work my way up to it. I won't dive into a $200 the whiskey cocktail.
Or if it's, you know, your birthday and
sure,
Kansas, a night on the town with this special someone. These are all good reasons,
yeah,
right?
And you mentioned the word luxury, and it wasn't hyperbole. You know, you mentioned the fact that the bottle's $1,500, and I've spoken to other spirits entrepreneurs, and I'm curious if this affects the luxury spirits end. It's a bureaucratic nightmare to get your beverage on a shelf because of limited space for you know, liquor stores and stores around the country. And this is all people. I mean, I spoke to Scottie Pippen, and he launched a bourbon last year, and he talked about the struggles of getting on shelves. Even though he's Scottie Pippen, a top 50 NBA Hall of Famer, he still has struggles getting on shelves.
We have actually the opposite problem. We don't have enough Macklow to put on the shelves. We've only released 3 casks, 230 to 257 bottles each.
Wow.
Every bottle is pre-sold, pre-allocated. They're sold. They never hit the shelves.
Wow.
They're gone before. The retailers, we have over 1,000 person wait list on our website. I think 60 people got a bottle for this release. The retailers call us all the time asking how they can get them. Unfortunately, we just don't have the product. I'm sure Scottie Pippen has a much larger stockpile than we have. Unfortunately, our product is so uber limited because our private collection, these were casks that Ian McMillan, who I can go back to the story of how I met Ian, but he and I were only able to acquire a handful of these iconic special casks. They were purchased at extraordinary cost while we laid down our own liquid, which started in 2019.
Wow.
And because they're so special and unique, each one only is a single cask bottling. That means it's only one cask that's bottled. We could sell 20 times more than we actually make. we have the opposite problem. I don't have enough product.
Wow. And so you mentioned you got these four casts. What happens when you run out, or is that something you don't have to worry about for quite a while because of your...
No, it isn't. So we have for 20, starting this November, it'll be our fourth release. That'll be cask 58. We already have people signing up on our wait list for it. We choose by lottery who gets them. And basically, we'll have probably three releases in 2023 up till our signature Kentucky product comes out around this time next year. And even that will be maybe 500 bottles. Wow. So it's not a very large amount. And so we have to really handpick the places that get them. We only work with the best on-premise restaurants. For instance, we're launching Texas this fall in Aspen. To give you a sense, the entire market of Texas, which is really going to be targeted at Dallas and a few places in Houston,
right,
it's about 50 bottles.
Wow.
So you can imagine it's not a lot. The entire state of Colorado, which is really Aspen, since that's where I spend my time, they might get 20 bottles. So we're super limited in our quantities.
Wow. I'm curious in terms of like the entrepreneurial thinking, because most entrepreneurs be like, I got to get these bottles out. I got to sell as many as I can. You have to have the patience of a saint to be talking about 10 bottles here, 20 bottles here.
I know.
What is it about that? Where does that come from? Because I think most entrepreneurs could not handle that.
So patience is not my virtue.
You can fool me.
But I do recognize that age takes time with whiskey. And people have to recognize an 8-year-old Oregon product, which we released, is similar in a taste profile and competes with the 25-year-old Scotch. Now, why is that? In Scotland, the temperature is much more 55, 60 degrees, up, down, 5, 10 degrees. In Kentucky, where my casks lie down, it goes from 20 degrees to 100 degrees.
Right.
So you have a lot more input and output on the wood, which changes the flavor profile much more severely, to the point that a 1-year Kentucky product actually color-wise looks like a 10-year Scotland product. It might be, in fact, darker. So
wow.
We also use all new American oak. We keep it in the same vessel, so the color comes into it much quicker, as does the taste and the profile. It also means that our ideal bottling point might be 4 to 6 years, not at 20 years, because Ian McMillan and myself choose when each cask is ready and when we're ready to blend it. So far, we've only done the exceptional individual casks, but we're already starting to look into our release next year and have earmarked the couple casks that we think will be the ones that are ready.
Mm. And another thing I've discovered by speaking to spirit entrepreneurs is it's sort of a boys club. It's sort of the old school people that have been doing it for years. And I know you're a bit of a luxury piece, but I wonder, what was the experience like trying to break in as a woman who'd never done this before in that industry? Like, is the industry standoffish?
That's a good question. So look, I'm used to being in a male-dominated industry.
I've noticed that, yes.
I worked in finance for, I'd say, the who's who, and that was 99.9% men. So I'm used to that. I don't really think much of it. I actually felt like the industry on the whole has been very welcoming to having women in it. I think, do you find some random people who are like, why are you doing this? Of course you do. But overall, I've had a wonderful experience. I think people have loved that we've brought a new take on things, that we're telling a lifestyle and a brand story, not a distillery story. That was never my goal. And my goal, even though we've been laying down our own product, is to really talk about the Macklow brand, because I believe that the Macklow name is very well known, and to tell a story about our brand, our family, the history through the whiskey.
Interesting. And that is, again, not a dark spirits person, but that sort of goes against what everyone else does. Other people, it's all about the distillery. It's like, it's been in this, or we've been doing this in this country for 1,000 years.
Like, we do not need another distillery story. There are too many. I don't care. That's great that people tell distillery stories. You're talking to somebody who is a whiskey nerd.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of the day, I don't think most people can tell you you know, the exact place their vodka or their gin or their tequila has been made, or have they actually gone and seen those plants? And some have, and that's awesome. And we do have, obviously, a distillery who's our exclusive partner down in Kentucky that we work with. But I'm not looking to sit there and run a distillery. I've chosen the best people in the world to do it. They're very good at doing it. We work together on this project. I'm their only single malt brand that they work with. And we have created an amazing product as a result. But what we want to do is tell a lifestyle story about the Macklow brand, about why it's great to have an elevated luxury experience like you would with a glass of Dom Pérignon and a celebration, and all of that inclusion of both men and women and the idea of being iconic and American. And I think that is what has not been focused on before.
Hmm. And you name dropped Ian McMillan a couple times. You've mentioned you're a self-proclaimed whiskey lover, but Ian McMillan, he has the receipts. He is a master distiller, so you obviously couldn't do this without him. How did that collaboration happen, and what was that like?
Yeah, so I actually, thankfully, pre-COVID, was hanging out in Isla, Scotland, where I decided to start playing golf a lot more. And I was like, with my friends from a very well-known distillery in Isla, I was like, hey guys, I have this crazy idea. I want to do a luxury American single malt. But I really, although I know I like, I really need a fabulous blender. Who's the best in the world? And they introduced me to Ian McMillan. He's obviously been in the business close to 50 years. He was the master blender for Byrne Stewart, who makes Bunnehabhain, Tolmeroy, Deanston. He also brought the Blaenau Distillery into the Lovelife back to life. He's really one of the greatest living masters and blenders of whiskey. And thankfully, when I told him about the idea, Ian said yes, he would work on it. And I actually had a call with him right before this today. We communicate all the time. And the Macklow was born. And I think without him, obviously, we could not do this. Oddly enough, Ian and I don't disagree on many things. I'd say we mostly agree, which has made it very easy to work with him.
And you mentioned a couple times the fact that you've basically worked in male-dominated industries and you have this connection with Ian off the jump. Again, is all of your years working in finance and in businesses prepared you to partner with someone like Ian who's a completely different person than you? He's been living in the whiskey barrels for 50 years. You've been skiing in slopes and traveling the world. So two totally different people, yet you're able to combine your forces together to create this product. Explain that to me.
Yeah, so I think in my many careers and journeys, what I've really realized is that you always want to work with the best people. And when I've looked at CEOs and entrepreneurs from a point of investing in them and viewing their companies, the ones that always really stand out are the ones who have the best teams around them. Mm. So in partnering with Ian, my goal was really to find the best person who I could work with on this project. And Ian and I created our farm-to-table philosophy that everything would be locally sourced, that we would do these casks of distinction. He and I tried hundreds of samples from all around the U.S. There were only a handful of these barrels Ian was even willing to put his name on.
Wow.
Well, our product that we created from scratch aged. And this idea of doing non-chill filtration, which a lot of the guys don't believe in, because sometimes you do get hazy golden cloud nuggets of flavor proteins in the bottles that people don't understand. Like, these are all philosophies that he and I would talk about. Even prior to this, we were going through tasting notes for some of our casks coming up next year. But Ian obviously can do things like nose new make. I've taken classes on it. I don't do it for a living. I have to trust that Ian can try a new make, a 1 year, a 2 year, a 3 year, and really knows the faults. Did I do a barrel unification class at Moonshine University? Yes, to get more knowledgeable. But I can never have the knowledge Ian has with his 50 years of experience.
Wow.
So I'm so happy to have him as part of our team. And I think with that, you know, one of our recent hires we just had was this amazing woman, Sabine Lapetit, out of Winebow. And she is a very senior hire for us, who's going to help us double our sales in New York. I mean, we're fortunate enough that we'll do over $1 million our first year in business.
Wow.
Our goal is to double, if not triple, that next year. And it's having, I think, the best team around you that allows us to grow in a steady way. To your point, I do have patience. I'm lucky I've funded this with my husband on our own. So we're able to be patient and do it the correct way. And we don't have to just say, oh, we're going to put out product. We want to put out perfect product that Ian and I both sign off on, that we really believe in. And I think that's where we have an edge over a lot of people. We're not just looking to churn and burn. We want to really take the time to have exceptional things that we put in the market. And if it's not exceptional, we just don't want to do it.
Hmm. And I'm curious what your friends think about what you're doing now. And your well-heeled friends are used to extravagant tastes, you know, the Dom Perignons and everything. Do they hit you up and be like, hey, Julie, can we get a bottle of Maclo? Like, what do you do with those folks who are hitting you up for bottles of Maclo?
Well, we don't have any free products. Everyone who has a bottle purchased it.
Okay.
Yeah, and they obviously are all amazing customers in all of these on-premise accounts, whether it's Cipriani's, Casa Cipriani's, Carbone, The Grill, Lobster Club, Sistina. We're in all of these amazing doors in New York City, and I always have people sending me screenshots of where they see a Maclo, with them drinking a Maclo. So I'm very fortunate to have a fantastic network of friends who are drinking it, buying it, sharing it with their friends. And you'd be surprised of the amount of people that come to me. In fact, I was at Avra doing a training, because I really try and train personally as many of the teams as I can. And in between two trainings, because often there's two shifts, so we'll do two, this guy at the bar was like, oh my God, somebody told me you're Julie Maclo. I've been on your wait list for like 6 months. How do I get a bottle of the Maclo? I'm like, well, you happen to have the right person. And I was so blown away that he was not only drinking the first shot at Avra, but so happy that, yes, we will make sure he gets a bottle, because of his true excitement was just, I was blown away by it. I'm like, I don't even know this guy. It's amazing.
That's funny. So, well, you must have good friends, because from my experience, I know rich people don't like to pay for things. They get to a certain level where people, they expect them to gift them.
I will say, when people know it's worth it,
yeah,
they do pay for it.
Good.
I think that's been our philosophy. If it's worth it, buy it. If it's not, don't. The fact that we're sold out and I have people just asking me how they can buy and get the bottles is a testament to the quality and how extraordinary it is. We have not given any bottles for free. In fact, the only bottle I think that went for free was to Ian.
Well, that makes sense.
His name is on it, so he gets one.
Yeah, that makes sense. And because, you know, it's funny, because I've spoken to top New York chefs, and their big thing is like they hang out with celebrities and so and so. But I say, you know, does Bono get a free dinner? And they're like, nope, Bono pays too. So you've got the right mindset, because I feel like a lot of these people that are either in hospitality and stuff, you know, give away the farm thinking that they're just making friends. But
I don't have enough to even complete my trainings.
Wow.
With so few bottles. When we get to our trainings, it's a teeny, teeny nip just to try it. We only get really trained the head bartenders and the best servers and sommeliers at each point. So it's such rare liquid. And it's so exceptional that I think people are really just so happy to get the bottle. And,
wow,
you know, I myself only have one bottle from each edition.
Huh.
And it's really very coveted. We don't give anything away, only because we have so few of them.
Yeah. Does Stevie Cohen buy a bottle, the aforementioned Stevie Cohen?
He does. So he does have a bottle of every single release.
That's awesome. And I will tell you, if you get a chance to speak to him, coming from a Mets fan, I'm very happy and fortunate that he decided to buy the Mets, and he's doing a wonderful job as the owner of the Mets. And he obviously has good taste if he's bought four bottles of the Maclo. So,
yes, I was at dinner with him and his wife, Alex, not long ago, and they had it on their bar, and they love it.
Oh, awesome. Wonderful. Oh, let me ask you a weird question to close, because I know with tickets and other things that are, you know, in the auction world, there's this sort of secondary market for things. Is there a secondary market for the Macklow where people are buying a bottle and flipping it?
Crazy you asked me this question. So I've been so annoyed. Obviously, MSRP is the suggested selling price. We cannot control it. A few of my friends have tried to buy bottles from retailers and have been charged up to $3,000 for the bottle. We have seen them go into Canada for almost double that, and on eBay for around double that too, in the $5,000 to $6,000 range, which I guess is a testament to our brand, but it upsets me. I would prefer, if I could, that everyone would get it at closer to the actual price it should be. But likewise, well, we have some amazing partners who really do try and keep our shop price close to $200 for 2 ounces. Mm-hmm. There are many places that charge $300-$400 for a shot of the Macklow.
Wow.
Again, they're not going to sell it as quickly as those who sell it $185 to $200 range, and we really do see great velocity there. So, of course, as a brand founder, we want more people to get to try it and experience this exceptional liquid and the smooth taste profile and how exceptional American single malt whiskey really can be. But unfortunately, I just have no control over that process.
All right, cool. Well, I was wondering, is your husband and your family, what do they think of the fact that they've got a liquor entrepreneur in the family now? Like, is this something that was like, is on brand for Julie? We're like, oh yeah, this makes total sense. Or were people surprised?
Oh, yeah. No one's surprised. Everyone's like, how did it take you so long? And my husband and I actually, as crazy as this might sound, we have always shared an office because I run our family office in addition to doing this on the side. And every single person who has heard of the Macklow whiskey is like, oh no, this makes sense. Like, why were you doing skincare? That made no sense. Like, you having a whiskey business, like, that must be your calling in life. And so I think I've always been known as drinking single malt, love my brown spirits. I've never met a rare whiskey that I haven't loved or tried. Well, actually, quite a few I haven't loved. Many I have tried. And if you come over to my house, we'll pour you a 1969 Springbank and a Hibiki and an Ardbeg. And we have a very wide range of whiskeys. And my husband would refer to me as the Master Somm. I'm actually a whiskey, registered whiskey ambassador and taster. So I have a very, very varied palate, and I actually can blind taste most whiskeys and have a pretty good sense what they are.
Oh,
so
that's awesome.
It is a very authentic experience to me personally.
That's so cool. All right. And the last question is, I've spoken to people that are in food, and they're high level, 5-star chefs, all that jazz, but they'll go to a In-N-Out burger, or they'll go to a Five Guys and they'll enjoy a burger. I'm going to ask that question to you for when it comes to whiskey. Of all the bodega whiskeys or the wine discount liquidators whiskeys, is there a good whiskey that you think is like, man, for the price, that's an excellent whiskey?
So, as I said, I've tried whiskeys on the spectrum. One of the best deals for me out there is a Bushmills.
Really?
I mean, you can get a nice Irish blend Bushmills. It's light. It's easy to drink. I've had whiskeys that cost, you know, $20,000 for the bottle. So they're undrinkable, by the way.
Wow.
I recently opened a 1954 Strathila, and I was shocked how undrinkable it was.
Wow.
And how much wood was in it. It was syrupy, and it really just shouldn't have. There's sometimes the 40-year-old whiskeys are better off staying bottled versus being opened.
Wow. Did you write up like a negative Google review or Yelp review for that?
No, it's a bottle I bought out of auction. It's a very coveted bottle. In fact, there's one in the Sotheby's auction right now as well. Look, I'm fortunate that I'm in a position where I can open these bottles and try them. A lot of times, unfortunately, whiskey collectors just buy the bottles and keep them.
Uh-huh.
I really try to get two when I can. And we like to open them and try them. I mean, part of drinking great whiskeys is creating great memories, I'd say. Uh-huh. So we try to try new things, fun things. And I don't think just because something is older makes it better. I think every whiskey is a little bit different.
Hmm. All right. Well, yeah. She is Julie Macklow. She's the founder of The Macklow, American Single Malt Whiskey. Julie, thank you so much for the time. I appreciate you telling me your story and talking about The Macklow. And who knows, maybe one of these days I'll sit down and sip a $200 Macklow Cosmopolitan one of these days.
It would be my pleasure to get you a shot when I see you.
All right. Thank you, Julie. Thanks for the time.
Take care.
And if you want to get on that Macklow waiting list, make sure you go to themacklow.com. And that wraps up this episode of the Forbes Books Podcast. If you enjoy the show, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you automatically get new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I would love if you left us a review so more amazing entrepreneurs like yourself can discover the show. And please don't forget the golden rule and treat others as you want to be treated. Until next time, adios.